Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. I live in a major city, like millions of other people in America, which means, like millions of other people, I never know exactly when I'll next encounter someone who's homeless. So for a few years now, I've had a kind of personal policy on these encounters. I choose a homeless person to get to know. Here in Los Angeles, it's Wolf. Wolf has a corner he works. He keeps pretty busy. He gives directions, he warns tourists not to walk through certain infamous tunnels downtown, and he tells stories. Naturally, he tells stories about life on the street. I listen to Wolf's stories, and I give him money once a week. I talk to him sometimes about getting treatment for the sores on his feet and getting into a shelter. But mostly, I just try to have an honest relationship with Wolf. I try to be his friend, because I've been told that one of the worst things about life on the street is that you no longer have personal and meaningful contact with other human beings, that society gives up on you, and you're left to the voices and the torments of your own mind. I wonder how I'd survive on the street if everyone looked right through me as they walked past, or if they shamefacedly crushed a few bucks in my hand. What would that be like? In the next half hour or so, you'll get at least a small sense of what it feels like to live outside the accepted boundaries of society. Producer Helen Borton introduces us now to four people who've been homeless and want to tell their stories about what it's like to be lost in America. By the way, a note of caution about this story. Some of the descriptions are quite graphic and may not be suitable for some listeners.
Paper sold by the homeless. Your neighbor, one of the world's nicest homeless people, earn a living without begging. That's me. In this issue, we're highlighting the many ethnic restaurants and restaurants.
I'm hungry. Would someone please tell me to get something to eat? I'm hungry blind, man.
First of all, you have to realize, if you live in the streets, the first thing that you have to try to do is learn any kind of way of survival. And I don't mean stealing or ripping somebody off. And I was lucky to have my own money. But I found that if you are tired, your best bet to sleep is in the middle of a sidewalk in a crowded shopping area. And nobody's going to basically rip you off.
My sister had dubbed me the sophisticated bag lady because I only use designer bags. My sister bought designer clothes, so I would use her plastic bags.
You know, a shelter is not a home. I remember sitting in that bed in a filthy shelter with all these men, smelling these men, you know. I remember one time I was in the purple section, and they had a guy who had body ulcers, and he had to go to the hospital every day to bathe these body ulcers. And I mean, the smell from these things were awful. Open sores, you know what I mean?
I lived on the Bowery. You would get what you call a meal ticket, and they would assign you to these hotels, and they assigned me to one called a Sunshine Hotel. And I'm walking up these stairs in this dark room, and I'm afraid to death because I know 90% of the people up here are drug addicts. And sure enough, it's one guy and his buddy. They got a knife to this guy's throat, and they are taking his wallet and cutting everything out of his pocket. And as God is my witness, you would never believe it. This next guy is laying in the middle of the hotel. This guy is laying there just masturbating. Right in the middle of all of that.
There is a way to keep clean in the street. Because I used to go to McDonald's, strip my clothes in the bathroom, wash myself in my hair, and then I used to take all my dirty clothes, pile them in a duffel bag, which was on my back all the time, go to the laundromat, do my clothes, fold them up in the backpack, and then when I needed to change clothes, back to McDonald's bathroom I went. Change my clothes.
I would crash on family and friend. I would sleep on the couch. I would see my daughter. I would, you know, dash in, and I was always fashionable. I would always run into men that had money, so therefore I always dressed well. I always dressed well.
These guys on each floor, it would be these different set of drug addicts. Now, the ones who live on the third floor, they are better than the guy who live on the second floor. Don't let these guys come up here. We sit on our bed and we do this every day. And then you go up on the fourth floor where there's cubicles and these guys got the room. They are better than the guys on the third floor. And they all are drug addicts. They all are doing the same thing.
I had a small clientele because I was determined to survive, and I was not going to ask, and I was not going to go home. I didn't have bums, and I didn't have street corner action. I had a set clientele. No pimp, none of that kind of thing. There was a time when this pimp did try to, get me involved. But by the grace of God, the night before, he was going to pick me up and put me on the corner on 42nd Street. Someone stabbed him in his private part. I'm not lying, this is so strange.
I never really made any friends in Ohio much, and I was kind of stayed by myself. Because sighted people have a very negative attitude toward blind people, and they didn't want to teach me how to play their games or anything, so I spent most of my time by myself. My mother did some very, barbaric kind of behavior things. Like, one time I was crying and she put my head in a basin of cold water and held me under the water. My father was a pharmacist and had plenty of pills in the house, and I just used to take them because I used to see my parents high, so, I used to go in the cabinet and just pull out bottles of pills and let me see what happens if I take three or four of these. Let me see what happens if I take five or six of these.
But you couldn't even see those.
That's right.
You didn't know what you were taking.
That's right. For a long time, I didn't. And I didn't care as long as I felt high. We left Ohio to move to Connecticut, and basically because Ohio was getting to be too many problems. My father couldn't find a job. I hated school. And my brother hated school. My sister, we couldn't do anything with. And so my sister was placed in a mental institution because she's retarded and blind. My father's dead now, thankfully. I'm very grateful for that.
Did your father physically abuse you?
Well, I don't really want to get into that.
Was he also cruel to you as your mother had been?
Cruel enough.
So I always had the top of the line plastic bags to pack my things in. And sometimes it got to the point where I would just pack them in big green industrial bags and just go. And until I get tired of me, I just pack my stuff in a green bag and hit the road. I was here, there, and everywhere. And when my daughter would see me, she would never know. She never knew I was drunk. She'll tell you today, she never saw me drunk. And I thought I was the life of the party. I was thinking I was the life of the party.
Sometimes people used to ask me for advice. And people would ask me, well, gee, it's cold out here, my feet are freezing. So, you know, I might go in and tell the guy, oh, hey, give me a newspaper. And show them how to stick the newspaper in your shoes so you don't have to freeze your toes off.
I would stay maybe 2 days here. At one point, I would just move in, stay as long as I could or as long as they could stand me. All a form of prostitution, be I met them on the job, or I met them at a bar, or I'd live with them for a year, or I'd live with them for a week or two. It was still, to me, a form of prostitution because I was miserable. There were times when, of course, I didn't want to have sex, but the incentive was, I'm going to get my way. I'm going to be able to sleep late. The money's going to be on the dresser. I don't have to bother with him when I get up. I would cook, and I would clean, and I would earn my keep. But I'd have to have my vodka in order to cook and to clean and to earn my keep. And I knew that I was out of control because I couldn't do anything without having a drink. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. This was a nice house, and there was 10 of us, 10 children, so it was rather crowded. But we had practically everything a child could want, being not rich or wealthy. We had piano, record player. We went to church. We had a pew. We would all come to church together, the mother, father, and the little ducklings, you know, in tow, and fill the pew, and all well-dressed and well-spoken and well-mannered. We had family discussion. We had wonderful things in the home to occupy ourselves. And the mother was there cooking, baking, sewing, cleaning, nurturing, giving whoopings, building careers, setting goals. Except the soldier. I don't know, maybe if I had told her about Roger, his name is Roger, my brother, maybe she would have filled all those caps. I recall from the age of 7, my brother was in his teens. When he felt, come and take me to the basement and do what he felt he had to do. And he would lay his penis between my legs and ejaculate. And I can remember the smell of semen and the feel of it like the paste you use to put up wallpaper. And I never forgot that. I never told anyone about that, and I never said anything about my father in later years when I was a teenager. My father would place his penis between my legs with my vagina until he reached climax. And then he would say to me, all right, go on now, go on, you know. But he would have this look of fear, pain, and please forgive me. I knew I had a way of controlling my father. I knew if I asked for that $5 and he didn't give it to me, I would give him a certain look and I would get that $5. Or if I asked, could I go to my friend's home, and he would come up with that paternal, no, you can't because it's late, blah, 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 I would give him that certain look, or I'd walk away abruptly and he would know that she has something on me. So I held him hostage with that to get my way. My brother, from him to my father, to my uncle, it was just a continuous thing in my life.
I hung out with guys 2 or 3 years older than me. I was a thief. You know, I would go over to markets. I learned how to break into stores early. My first arrest was 11 years old. You know, I started to drag my mother through family court system. I remember when they first put parking meters up in Manhattan, and I was an expert in breaking in, and I can get in a meter in less than 2 minutes. I can do a whole block within a half an hour, clean every meter out. I was nervous, especially around girls. I didn't like myself. I didn't like the way I looked. You know, I felt very inadequate, you know. And when I would drink or use other substances, these feelings of inadequacy were removed, so I think I had a magic potion.
These guys would be standing on the corner, you know, how guys would do drugs, their eyes had closed, and I'd be saying, man, I wish I looked like that. To me, they look, you know, here, I'm in the Army, out of the Army, and Harley was shaving. I wanted to look grown, look macho, look mean, you know. This old clean-shaven guy, you know, I didn't want to be that. I was born in Georgia. I was born on a family's farm. I remember loving my mother a lot and we being real close, and I remember having a great sense of loss and feeling like she didn't love me no more because she got married and left me there. I think I was 9 when my mother got remarried and she moved to Detroit. I never saw my mother again. My great uncle, He was a country preacher. He was very strict. He wasn't a mean, evil person, but at the time, it seemed that way to me because I hated working on the farm. I wanted to be with my mother. I had a sense that these are not my parents. So somewhere in the back of my mind, I was kind of rejecting everything that they said or tried to do. It's just hard to imagine someone loving their mother more than me. Sometimes when I would do some bad things, they would say, take that boy in the other room and give him a good spanking. And she would go in and lock the door, and she would say, now I want you to holler. And she would beat against the wall. She never would beat me. She would hit against the wall and say, you cry, so they'd think I'm beating you. My mother was dear. She was dear to me. The man that she married was an alcoholic. I remember my mother writing me and saying he hit her over the head with the butt end of a gun. 2 years later, my mother died from that same injury. She caught cancer about 9 months later in that same injury where he hit her. So I lived with a lot of hate toward him for a lot of years.
I often wonder if my mother knew. And she was an immaculate woman, and she always smelled Comet. And I often wondered if this persistent cleaning was part of her way of removing the filth that she felt. She smelled of Comet all the time. And that tore at my heart, it tears at my heart. How, if she did know, or anybody else knew, how they could not say anything or go along with it. How could you? Well, how come you didn't know? It's a pain that never goes away. It never goes away. I don't care what anyone says, therapy, all this crap. It eats the very core of your soul. I met this man, and I thought that he was my knight with shining armor. I left home with Artie, who is my daughter's father, because I thought that leaving home would be sweet. You know, you have somebody that cares for you and they're gonna be there at your beck and call, and everything you thought that you needed at home, they are going to give you. And Artie was not who I thought he was. And I came to find that Artie was married. Artie had children. He was just not who he appeared to be. Things start to get out of control. I just started drinking. I started doing pills, cocaine, sniffed cocaine, sniffed heroin. I did the crack thing, all of it. I got involved with some kooky people. I lost my job. I lost my apartment. And I lost all the beautiful things that I had. I saw my things being put on a sanitation truck, and I was out there.
When I got out of high school and came to New York, I took college prep courses at NYU, and I did very well.
What was driving you, Sharon?
I wanted to learn so bad. But I had so many problems with my family that it caused me to snap. We had trouble with a police officer because he came to my house with my father and told me I had to be living with my father because I was handicapped. And I told him, get the hell out of my house. And then you come back for your stuff and, oh, I can't give it to you. It's gone. Nobody would ever say to me, well, why are you so dissatisfied with the program? Why don't you... stay? And I ran away from the program.
Why were you so dissatisfied? What didn't you like?
I didn't like living with rats. I didn't really receive much help with the problem. And one night, a rat attacked me, and I went for my throat almost when I jumped. Then he jumped off me, but he could have killed me. I just took off, put a bag of clothes together, and ran. During the day, I used to walk and walk and walk and walk. You usually know about when you're going to pick up off the street, especially if you hit days and you don't feel like walking around. You'd rather sit on the sidewalk. I had been thrown in several times into a hospital for being out on the street homeless. If I knew I was going to get picked up and put in the hospital, I'd take an overdose of pills. Go in the bathroom, swallow the whole bottle, because then I could sleep and I wouldn't have to worry about being locked up. Because I was blind, they kept me locked up all the time.
I was coming down the block to go to return to the halfway house, and there was all this commotion going on, and I was drawn to this area. And once I got to the crowd, I couldn't get through to see exactly what was going on, but there was a man that was sitting on the street, and he told me the whole story. This friend had stabbed this other friend, and the person was stabbed up so badly that there was so much blood he couldn't see exactly who it was, so he didn't have a name. And so when I returned to the halfway house, anyway, I come to find out that that was my brother. My sister became bored with the marriage and started to grow into herself, and she wanted to work and he wouldn't let her. She wanted to have friends, he wouldn't let her. She wanted to become, and he would not let her. So then she became promiscuous. And things got to a point where he couldn't take it anymore and he blew her brains out. He shot her one morning when she was preparing to go to work. He shot her at least 7 times. My oldest brother died. My sister was killed. My brother was killed. And my brother died of AIDS in 1 year. In the course of the first year of my recovery. And I went to these wakes one behind the other. And the liquor was there. But I was so serene and peaceful and free, till I still don't understand what happened to me. But I know I did not pick up a drink. I did not pick up a pill. This voice came to me as clear as I'm talking to you, said to me, "You'll never, no matter what happens, you'll never have to drink again."
I got high because I didn't want to deal with reality at period. You know what I'm saying? Every month, I would say, I'm going to do the right thing. The VA was telling me, sending me letters. "Mr. Adams, you know, you're eligible for Chapter 31. You can go back to school. You can go back to college. Are you ready? Let us know." I would think about these things, and the first of the month, I would get the checks, and I would, you know, drink and drug the money up. And then I would slide my behind back into a shelter, real depressed and messed up again. But this time was different. I was tired of living like this. And I got there that night, all the way from the Bronx to the last stop out in Brooklyn, Fort Hamilton. And the beds were full. And I wasn't going back no place. Then I went and came back to the hospital. I went in the men's bathroom. And I cut my wrist. And 7 days later, when I got off a suicide watch, they handed me back my belt, my shoelaces, and a whole lot of other stuff. The only thing I was looking for was this telephone number of my friend who was in AA. I got to call him. I said, "Ronnie, I'm ready to do it. I'm willing to do anything that's necessary." I went back to college, and I got to the point and started making the dean's list. And in high school, the only time I seen the dean was for deviant behavior. Now all I was making the dean list for academic achievement. I'm graduating from Lehman University next month. I'm getting a bachelor's of art in sociology. But as a junior there, I won a $45,000 scholarship for graduate school. At a citywide competition, I was one of the four winners, and I'm a Clark Fellow.
I have a job, desk manager, right up in the front, right here at the Delta. And it was a lot of fighting I had to do to get it, but I won it. 6 years is the longest I've been out of a hospital. 6 years is the longest that I haven't been homeless. My friend Frank, you know, we're like brother and sister. We're the best of friends in this building. We go shopping. We go window browsing. We go for walks in the park.
With everything I have gone through, I have a style that I like to live, which is peaceful and calm, because I need all the peace I can get. And, of course, living in single-room occupancies, you're not going to find that all the time, whereas I have had been able to do what I want to do when I want to do it. I didn't have to share a kitchen. I didn't have to share a bathroom. I didn't have to wait for somebody to come out the shower. And I'm 43 years old, and I'm like, I shouldn't have to be doing this today. But I also had to realize the walk that I had walked to get to this point.
But a lot of people in the street are very nice people. It's not everybody who's bad. Everybody puts the down, as far as somebody being homeless, as a complete downer. It isn't. Because not just do you learn to survive, you learn to talk to other people who outright are friendly.
Lost in America was produced by Helen Borton, with special thanks to Ellen Baxter, a pioneer in the field of housing for the homeless. The show was mixed by Marilyn Reese. It originally aired as part of A Sense of Place, written and produced by Helen Borton, and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Sharon Zack, Bill Adams, Lynn Terry, and Roosevelt Douglas all live in single-room occupancy residences today. That's housing for the homeless that includes social workers on the premises and government-subsidized rents. This program, along with most of our shows, is archived online at soundprint.org. Support for Soundprint comes from ToadNet, a provider of business and residential DSL throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Visit toad.net to learn more about ToadNet's internet services or call 877-GET-TOAD. On the next Soundprint, memories of summer camp, the sounds, the smells, the people. CDs are available of all of our programs. To order, call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. You can also order online on the website at soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We're always checking the mail, so if you have questions or comments for us, don't hesitate. Our email is talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is technical director Anna Maria DeFreitas, associate producer Katie Gott, and sound engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.